I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. The mass murders last year at a community center in San Bernardino, a college classroom in Oregon, a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado, and a church in Charleston, South Carolina, generated big headlines and heated debates about gun control and gun rights. What doesn't get the same amount of attention is the everyday gun violence in many American cities. A growing number of people in the crime-fighting community believe that rather than arguing about passing new gun laws to reduce crime rate, focus on on-the-street interventions with high-risk youth in high-crime neighborhoods. There are some crime-fighting strategies that use a more public health approach, a more tough-love approach, that have shown promise in reducing violent crime, and it's our topic for today's Radio Times. We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Scott Thompson is chief of the Camden County Police Department. He'll be talking with us about a program called Project Guardian. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. Also with us is Marla Davis Bellamy. She's director of the Philadelphia Ceasefire Program, and that's based at the Katz School of Medicine at Temple University. Marla Davis Bellamy, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
You're very welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests is Colwyn Williams. He's been working for Philadelphia Ceasefire for 3 years, currently working in the 22nd Police District in North Philadelphia as an outreach worker. He grew up in Bristol, Bucks County, just outside of Philadelphia, served 18.9 years in prison for armed robbery. He got out of prison in 2012. And Colwyn Williams, nice to have you with us on the show as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Very nice to have all three of you with us. And Marla, let me begin with you. Why do you think this more everyday kind of violence does not get the same amount of attention, perhaps even not the same amount of argument that we hear when we have these mass shootings?
Absolutely. We struggle with this, those of us who are engaged in this work in terms of violence prevention, because we know every day there are shootings and homicides that many of our own residents here in Philadelphia are just not aware of. And so we think it's incumbent upon us to really work to engage our residents in terms of our cities across the nation to talk about this notion of violence, the violence that we see every day. We're somewhat perplexed as to why we don't get the same coverage and same attention, particularly in terms of our cities wherein, for instance, in Philadelphia in 2013, the city reported that 5,051 young people between the ages of 14 and 24 had been shot and or killed. So when we talk about public emergency crisis, I believe we're at that point.
How about for you? And I'm looking at you, Scott Thompson.
Well, you know, the problem that's been plaguing a lot of inner cities, particularly with gun violence and the proliferation of guns on our streets, is something that has is not new, but it's something that we have seen get progressively worse over the years.
It's worse now?
Well, it is across the country, yes. And I think one of the things that we're starting to find is that crime fighting is not always the best solution to this, that we can find more sustainable success through community building and to employ other services and other experts in this. We're not going to arrest our way out of this problem. That's one thing that law enforcement has quickly learned. And many of the efforts that we're doing over in the city now are far more holistic, bringing in not just the prosecutor's office and the courts, but social services, the clergy, folks from reentry. You know, the community in and of itself, that is where the solution lies, and those are the folks that we need to facilitate, convene, and empower.
Is that because we will never resolve gun rights, gun control, that will never get resolved, so we have to really focus on sort of much more practical approaches?
Well, I don't think that there is, to, and pun intended, no silver bullet for this, right? I mean, even if we get the common sense legislation that would certainly help us stem the flow of illegal guns going to our streets, there still are over hundreds and hundreds of millions of guns that are out there now. And, you know, the genie is out of the bottle. And we need to focus on healing neighborhoods and not just on punitive measures and restrictive measures of focusing on the gun in and of itself.
Colwyn, let me turn to you and just talk a little bit about you have unique experience in that you served time in prison for armed robbery. Looking back at your younger self, you were about, what, 25 at the time?
Yes, ma'am.
Would some kind of intervention, do you think, have prevented you from committing that crime?
My father.
Your father.
Most of the things that go on out there in the community is a direct result of what they now deem a dysfunctional family. When you take the father out of the home, there's always the potential of dysfunction. And the streets become those children or these young adults' father. and the streets became my daddy. I came from a real good family, a strong mother, a strong grandmother, a family unit. But what was absent was a strong male role model.
Hmm.
You know, and I really strongly believe with implementing, putting that man back into the family home, the black man in particular, back into the family unit, a lot of these things that we're discussing now could be eradicated overnight.
Now, you spent almost 20 years, about 18, almost 19 years in prison. Did that rehabilitate you? Because clearly you're on a different path today.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, at first, you know, I mean, I was still bitter when I first started my incarceration. But, you know, the years that progressed, the horrific stories that progressed to me being incarcerated brought about dissatisfaction. And at the end of the day, you must be dissatisfied with your circumstances in order to have to be at least receptive to there's a different reality. There's a different hope. There's opportunity out there. And I decided to change prison into Princeton, jail into Yale. Not being upstate as opposed to me educating myself, gaining knowledge of who I am and the realities of the damage that I've caused because of my ignorance and my lack of being a man and being home for my family.
Was it just you were a more mature person? You had time to think about your life? Were there people that helped you once you were in prison? Or was this something you had to figure out for yourself?
I mean, all of the above. Well, one of the main horror stories that really brought about my dissatisfaction, the one that changed, is not being there for my children and watching young men meet their fathers, grandfathers, uncles, older brothers in Gratiford for the very first time and seeing from being inside looking out the deterioration of the family and therefore the community and the bodies, the many different young men and women who were dying continuously on a daily basis, not only in Philadelphia, but across the nation.
Well, I congratulate you on obviously what you have done with your life. And Marla, if I can turn back to you and talk about ceasefire, which is a public health approach, which is to say it's almost like a disease. That's what we're dealing with here.
Absolutely. Here in Philadelphia, we're housed in the Center for Bioethics, Urban Health and Policy at Temple School of Medicine. And we have been focusing on really preventing violence from occurring because we do look at it as a public health issue. We are a replication site of Cure Violence, which started in Chicago. Dr. Gary Slutkin, who's an epidemiologist, looked at violence as a disease, as it transmitted from person to person. And we're now one of 53 sites across the nation that are working on the front lines in terms of interrupting the spread of violence. And the way we do that is hiring individuals like Cohen Williams, who's a credible messenger. He's a person that many of our young people look up to. They believe that if he changed his life, that they too can change. And so we have about 140 or so young people that we mentor. We make 5 home visits, telephone calls, 3 telephone calls a week, staying in their ear about making better decisions in regards to their lives. Cohen was actually at a school earlier this morning talking to these young people about not giving away their power and being responsible for themselves. And so many of our young people, for whatever reason, they haven't gotten the right messaging. And then also people just not spending enough time with them. Oftentimes, our young men and women say, no one has ever taken an interest in me. And we take an interest in them. They're like family to us. And we do all that we can to put them on the right path. We help them in terms of identifying training opportunities, educational opportunities, and really talking to them about their future and setting short-term and long-term goals.
Well, let me turn to you, Scott Thompson, looking at what you're doing in Camden, which is Project Guardian. And I guess they're all sort of variations on the same kind of theme, but the idea of targeting certain at-risk youth, thinking we got to get to them before perhaps the streets get to them?
Right. It's a focused deterrence model. We're not necessarily targeting. What we're doing is we are assessing and first of all, we're opening up the lines of communication with everybody that possesses the pertinent information that we need to help formulate these decisions. We're talking to the schools. We're talking to the courts. We're talking to our community groups. And what we want to do is not be reactionary but be proactive, is that if there are youth that we're able to identify having challenges or issues or even having affiliations with individuals that are falling by the wayside, is for us to interact and to bring to them the services that are available – to help them make better decisions in life. And, you know, it's again, it's very holistic in what we do. And I want to commend Colwyn for what he does, because, you know, we have our own version of Colwyn that work with us, and Brian Morton and Mark Lee. And they have a very, very powerful message to the youth, because it's not just about storytelling. It's about empathy, and that they can relate because they came from the same streets and they made some of the same decisions. And this is not about right and wrong. This is about trying to fill the voids that exist. And the pathologies of poverty that are leading many of our problems, again, are not going to be fixed with a pair of handcuffs. So we're trying to be in front of the issue and to bring the help and the services needed to people. But I think one of the most important things in all that is the messaging to the children and the youth that they are incredibly important and that they just don't garner our attention when they do something wrong.
And I wonder, Colwyn, I mean, I think anyone who deals with teenagers can deal with that look that teenagers get. And I wonder, as you get to know some of these young people, once you get beneath the facade, you know, what they present to the world, who are these young people? I mean, what are they afraid of? What do they want for their lives?
Believe it or not, the average child want to live. They simply want to live, and they want to live in a safe environment, and they want to grow up to at least have the opportunity to develop to their maximum potential. I stress that I'm yet to meet at its innocent, which we attack this as a disease. But before this disease has actually took root in most of these children, you ask the average young girl, young lady, what she want to be when she grow up. She want to be a princess. She want to be a doctor. She want to be a lawyer. None of them say that they want to have children by multiple men. Mm-hmm. They want to be on welfare. They want to be caught into this environment that produces violence. The same thing with the young men. They usually want to be sports figure, doctor. They want to be something of substance to give back to the community. It's a learned behavior later on down the line when they start emulating what they see. And they end up in death row. None of them want to say, I want to be a lifer. I want to, you know, I wake up this morning, I want to kill five people, and I want to spend the rest of my life in prison. So it's a learned behavior.
And it's interesting, we have a police officer, a commissioner here, and also yourself, Colwyn. I know you work with the 22nd Police District. Is it also trying to fix or mend the relationship between the community, young people in the community, and the police?
Actually, all due respect, you know, our job is not law enforcement. You know, the police have a job to do. It's commendable whenever you find men like this policeman right here. What's your name again, sir? You know what I'm saying? In all due respect, you know, we our whole job is to police our own community. We want to start establishing the behavior by changing their way of thinking so it would make his job easier. There's a strained relationship between the community and the police with the media every day. And you're seeing a lot of these police officers abusing their authority. My whole thing is, you know, instead of arguing about being smacked, let's avoid, you know, and whether or not we should turn the other cheek, let's avoid being smacked in the first place.
And let's take a very short break. That's Colwyn Williams. Also with us, Scott Thompson and Marla Davis Bellamy. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We're talking about an approach to violence and gun violence that doesn't get a lot of attention. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Having a very off-air, interesting conversation here, talking with our three guests about anti-violence strategies that are working. And again, Scott Thompson is chief of the Camden County Police Department. They have a program there called Project Guardian. Also with us, Marla Davis Bellamy. She's director of the Philadelphia Ceasefire Program. It's based at the Katz School of Medicine at Temple University. Colwyn Williams has been working with Philadelphia Ceasefire for about 3 years, currently working in the 22nd Police District in North Philadelphia as an outreach worker for the group. And again, any questions or comments, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Scott Thompson, what we were all talking about, what three of you were saying, is just the important role that someone like Colwyn Williams plays. Talking about his own life, the mistakes that he's made, the decisions that he's made, how that resonates with young people. What, more than a police officer doing the same thing?
Well, sure. You know, there's strong social science research out there, and most of it came from David Kennedy from the National Network of Safe Neighborhoods, that talks about the importance and the significance of informal social control over formal social control and try to make that into English for other people. You know, formal social control is our gun, our badge, the sanctions that we're able to levy if things are not complied with. Informal social control is the impact that the people who have the referent authority within a community, the people that are respected, the people that are trusted. It's the Colwins, it's the Mrs. Jones who've lived on the corner for 20 years who, when she says quiet things down, even the most hardest of folks that are out there listen to what Mrs. Jones has to say. And it's about so law enforcement, by pulling in the expertise, by pulling in their ability to communicate and leveraging that, is we get far more distance in trying to connect with the youth through that way than if we stand up and hold the criminal code of New Jersey and say, well, here are the sanctions that you face if you commit this violation. That just doesn't resonate.
Can you talk about the Mrs. Joneses, Marla, in the community, the role they play?
Sure. And I think, you know, certainly pulling in individuals like Colwin is important, but we actually hire them. So Colwin is one of 13 staff members that are working full time for Temple University School of Medicine. And I just think that they are an untapped resource. They certainly have influence in terms of young people. But I think if we're very serious about addressing this whole notion of violence, we should employ them more. We should utilize them. Not just in terms of ceasefire, but other projects as well. Here in Philadelphia, about a quarter of our city's population are ex-offenders. And so we wonder, I don't think you have to have a PhD to understand what's happening in terms of violent crime. If a young person doesn't have an education, doesn't have a job, they're going to do something criminal. But I think that Colwin and certainly other individuals like him could make a difference in terms of their community. And so I would really like to see certainly law enforcement embrace them, in the sense that understanding that their influence is certainly one that changes the lives of individuals, but hire them. They need jobs. They need employment.
Well, I'm thinking about stop and frisk, and I want to toss that to all of you. But to you, Colwin, you deal with young people. How do they view stop and frisk?
You know, it's just a continuation of their view of the police and their behavior that's been constantly, consistently through media, social media, given to them. You know, it's harassment any way you look at it. You know, you walk down the street, you know, you got a hoodie on or you fit a certain stereotype. You know, nine times out of ten, you're going to be stopped. You're going to be frisked because you fit the stereotype. This is why I try to say how important it is to give these young men meaning and purpose. Once we give them meaning and purpose, and I'm moving with meaning and purpose, the percentage of me being stopped by the police diminishes. If I'm walking and I got my pants upright and I ain't need the hoodie on because I ain't strolling, that's not to say I can't wear a hoodie. If it's cold, you wear a hoodie. But I can eliminate the stereotype by the way I think and my behavior. If I'm on the corner 20, 30, 40 minutes and the bus done went by two or three times, then there's a problem with that look. You know, so you know, we got to ask ourselves, we have a certain responsibility as well. And I don't look outside the community for that responsibility. I look inside in the community. Like they said, we need to be able to go down there and talk their language and explain to them, look, there is opportunity out there. There is resources out there. There is people to declare. The police going to do their job. That's nature. I mean, we got natural antibodies that police our body. If we didn't have our natural antibody and T cells and white cells, we'd fall victim to germs and bacteria every day. We'd constantly be going to the doctor. So the only thing we want to do is be shot back into the system, you know, as an antibody, you know, and help them build the immune system back up. This is the whole model of cure violence. Like I said, let the police do their job. Let us police and do our jobs inside the community.
Do you see stop and frisk, Scott Thompson, as harassment? We've done untold numbers of hours on this very topic.
Right. Well, and I think stop and frisk is consistent with just about everything else in society. It's not just – it's not really what it's done. It's how it's done. There is a role. You know, police want – I mean, people want the public – I'm sorry. The public wants the police to interact with people that are suspicious, people that are reasonably believed to be committing criminal activity. So what's important from the police perspective is for us not to paint an entire broad brush of a community based upon one subject's or a few subjects' descriptions. Really, what we have been doing to best mitigate the problems that will come from massive stop and frisk type of efforts is to really embed the officers into the community, so they get to know who the good people are. They get to know who the kids are that are walking to school, that are waiting for the bus. You know, the people that live in that community want the police to give their undivided attention to the very, very small group of individuals that are negatively defining everyone's lives. What frustrates the community is when they all get treated in the same type of manner. And that is where the relationship building we have, which comes through communication and human contact with the people, helps that officer discern and rely upon the people in that community to help identify where the problems are.
You just said an important thing, Marla, which is that when we're talking about in cities like Camden or Philadelphia, which has a problem of violent crime, is that it tends to be a very small group of people responsible for much of the violent crime. For ceasefire, do you take that into account? I mean, trying to figure out who are you talking to?
Absolutely. We certainly agree with that. We try to identify individuals who are head of gangs, those who are certainly very influential in terms of their community, their peers. And that's who we target in terms of bringing into the fold, being able to work with them and helping them change their behavior, because we know that their influence will certainly have an impact on others. But we don't see these young people as bad people. We don't see anyone as bad people. We see these young people as individuals who have made some bad decisions. And all too often they say, well, no one told us that before. And so we spend time with them. We spend time with them and help them really better understand what some of the challenges are and how they can best address them, whether it's a challenge at home or whether it's a challenge in school, and certainly not utilizing violence, particularly gun violence, to resolve their differences and disputes. But I think that people can change, and I think knowing that Colin has changed his life, they know that they can change theirs as well.
When you say they don't know, they don't know that you're not supposed to do some of these things because no one told them?
Absolutely. They say that all the time.
A parent, an adult?
Absolutely. They say all the time, if I knew better, I would have done better. But no one told me that, or no one gave me that type of instruction. And I think all too often we have circumstances, whether it's at home or in the school, where there's their absent kind of authority figure, one who's kind of spending time with that individual and kind of teaching them right from wrong. But all too often they say they just didn't know.
Wow. Let me get Reverend Tim to join the conversation. And go ahead. You need to tell the listeners who you are, and go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Marty. This is Reverend Tim Merrill from Camden.
Morning, Reverend.
And always a pleasure to talk to you. Chief, good morning.
Good morning, Reverend Merrill. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You know, after over 40 years in dealing with these issues on the streets in Camden, one of the things I find, and Sister Bellamy hit on this, is that ours is a city that hasn't really invested in those community people who are able to do a couple things that are very important. And one of those things is to offer these adolescent males who are at the epicenter of this issue high energy, high adventure, safe, risky things that adolescent males need to be doing. Found out in the past, when we've taken the guys in the neighborhood white water rafting, the guys in the drug set aren't going to offer that. When we get you involved in high elements courses and athletic activities, but we're finding in Camden that many of those that do these things that can reach these young men have to do so only if they live in abject poverty, because we don't support them. And so the Colwins, who are supported and hired to do these things, are an essential element, because rather than targeting the males that are going to do these crimes, like the abject failure of the Youth Violence Initiative, Prevention Initiative in Philadelphia, because it doesn't work that way. It works in communities. So if you target Hakeem and you invest in Hakeem, guess what? If you take him out of the system, there are four guys that are going to replace him. So that's such an important element. And the other element, and I'd like to congratulate Chief Thompson on this, is coming in with the correct law enforcement attitude that starts to look at these other sectors, that brings clergy, that brings social services in, to know that, you know, aggressive policing isn't going to do this, and that this is much more than simply a law enforcement issue. It is an issue of culture and education and community and spirituality. And I think in places like Canada, we could hold those things together and support those people that can speak, have earned the right to speak in these young people's lives. We could see a drastic change in what's going on.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And actually, let me toss what you said originally to Colwin here, which is providing, I mean, what I hear Tim Merrill saying is that there's a kind of excitement of the street. So what do you give a young person that replaces that kind of excitement that means something to this young person?
You know, Marla, first I want to say, Marla pointed out, you know what I mean, that a lot of these young men, the first thing they say to us is, well, nobody taught us that. Now, we're not talking about verbal. You know, a lot of times I can tell you, don't do this. But my actions as a parent or as a so-called adult figure go contrary to that. So you know, I was never taught the consequences of my decision making. That's a difference.
Right.
You know what I mean? We want to let them know that there's consequences in your decision making. And like you, once again, you spoke about the Miss Jones. Well, now Miss Jones in the clubhouse. Miss Jones, you know, we Miss Jones has been eliminated for the most part because of the continuation, the deterioration of the family.
Because people are not, they're not listening to Mrs. Jones.
They're not listening. You know, so what we do, we provide them with a reality. Look, this is what I've done. Mm-hmm. This is where I've been. This is the consequences of, you know, and I'm home. Praise God, but this is what I've experienced. You don't have to experience that. Life is a one-shot deal. You give them purpose. A lot of these young men and women have become dream chasers. No one is giving them and establishing them the ability to visualize a reality 20, 30 years from now because their peers are dropping dead at 20, 21, 22 years old at the most. So they don't see 25. You know, so it's a joint effort for us to be able to go in there, you know, and talk to them, explain to them, look, this is the consequences of your actions. If you choose to do this, this is what you're going to get. And now everyone can't be saved. So you do have prisons and institutions for that type of behavior. And for those are just straight menaces. Usually that's a psychosis when someone cannot be rehabilitated. Mm. But like, you know, I'm a great advocate of freeing most of the lifers that I know of in Pennsylvania. Can you imagine those men who thought that they never had a chance to come home and give back to the community? Because those be the men and women who would never, you had never had to worry about coming home again. And they'll be so instrumental in the healing process of what's going on with this violence and these murders.
Tim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And we are talking about strategies, anti-violence strategies that are very different from the debate about gun control, gun rights. That's Colwyn Williams. He's been working with Philadelphia's Ceasefire for about 3 years. He's an outreach worker. Also with us, Marla Davis Bellamy, director of the Philadelphia Ceasefire Program, again based at the Katz School of Medicine at Temple University, and Scott Thompson, and he's chief of the Camden County Police Department. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm wondering, and what all three of you are talking about is investing not so much money, but time, relationship, energy, focusing on the relationship that these young people don't seem to have had. And a relationship takes a certain kind of effort, and one wonders, and I'm going to put this to you, Scott Thompson, because I was reading about the program that your program is based on that came from Boston, where they had amazing success for the first couple of years. They almost eliminated the gun violence in that city. But then after a couple of years, the program went away, and there was some infighting, and now they're sort of back to square one. What is the recipe for making sure that this becomes not just a kind of fad du jour, but really becomes institutionalized in a way?
Well, I'm not speaking specifically about Boston, but I can tell you that in anything we do in this realm, we have to understand that we will never have success, and we always view it as progress. Even when we have the measurable statistics, which we can celebrate at different points in time, we have to still remain with a mindset of remaining flexible, constantly reassessing what our situation is, and even being open to changing what we are currently doing, even though we've had success up until this point in time. You know, Colin made a great analogy earlier when he was talking about the human body and the antibodies and viruses, and it's just like anything else in crime fighting or social services, that things start to adapt over time. And what you're working to, what works today may not be working tomorrow. And we just can't abandon that. So I think that, you know, we have seen some progress in making this with Project Guardian. And we also have efforts that we're supporting, like you heard from Pastor Murrow, who called in, who, you know, Pastor Murrow and Angel Cordero and their efforts in East Camden have done tremendous things, extraordinary human beings, that because of their efforts, less mothers are burying their children. And that is as real as it gets. And but it's to not just have something, package it, market it, brand it, and then sit back and do interviews all day long, right? This is about constantly keeping your nose to the grindstone, right, and changing as things come up in front of you. But that is mostly contingent upon proximity. You have to maintain proximity to the streets, to the people that matter most, and be willing to listen what they have to say.
You know, Marla, I'm thinking about that prevention model, and I think everyone knows that prevention is such an effective way to deal with almost anything, but it becomes an afterthought. And when there are these mass shootings, then, you know, the idea of prevention sort of goes out the window. How do you make a case for this as a model that can work?
Sure. One of the things that we were just talking about yesterday is the business case. When you think about the millions, billions of dollars that gun violence is actually costing us, certainly those dollars could be redirected to preventive efforts like ours. But Cole and I were saying this morning that we don't talk about how to get out in front of the violence before it occurs. And that's what we do. So we're always keeping our ear to the ground, trying to listen about arguments that actually have occurred or when a shooting actually occurs. Oftentimes, there is plans in terms of retaliation. And so, for instance, even tonight, we have what we're kind of calling a life class, where we teach young people, our participants, anybody who wants to come, kind of life skills in terms of 101. So we're meeting them on the first Thursday and third Thursday of every month at the medical school. So we're talking to young people about how to deal with this whole notion of conflict, how to deal with anger, and really trying to change the heart of that individual, because all too often you have these external kind of influences, like you were talking about, focus deterrent, that may make an impact a year or two, you know, but you got to change the heart of the individual. And until you do that, I think everything else is just a band-aid.
Well, let's take a very short break. I do want to pick up on that. We are talking about some anti-violence strategies being used here in Philadelphia, also in Camden, New Jersey. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. If you're just joining us, we're talking about some crime-fighting strategies that use a public health approach or even a tough love approach that have shown some promise in reducing violent crime. And let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. Marla Davis Bellamy, director of the Philadelphia Ceasefire Program, again based at the Katz School of Medicine at Temple University. Colwyn Williams is an outreach worker for Philadelphia Ceasefire. And Scott Thompson, chief of the Camden County Police Department, where they have a program there called Project Guardian. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Cohen, let me go back to you, and in doing some of the homework or research for the show, it seems that a lot of the violence, or much of the violence, perhaps here in Philadelphia, it's a dispute. There's an argument. Someone is insulted. And then that's the thing that escalates. How do you intervene? How do you prevent that from escalating into something more violent?
I mean, if we're in the vicinity, you know, and we see the potential, one thing that we do, we try to mediate anything that may seem irrelevant to the average person that can go from 0 to 60.
Like what?
You bump me.
Oh, I bump you.
You bump me. Or how about you said something disrespectful on social media, or you said something to my sister or my brother. It'd be the smallest thing that can escalate. But this is, too, a result of violence. We call that post-traumatic stress disorder. Sometimes you just tighten your environment, your circumstances. And that's another thing that's not being addressed, that a lot of these actions or the way that they think is, in fact, a psychosis. So we try to stay on top of, like you said, with consistency, keeping our, you know, and remember, 85% of communication is body language. Mm. So when you're out there in that community, that environment, you can't see things always with the two physical eyes. You got to be down there engaged in the community in order to be effective, in order to get in front of and prevent these type of things. And what someone might say to someone might be interpreted differently than someone like myself that's constantly out there.
Are we talking about, Marla, and I know all three of you want to jump in, but are we talking about young people that actually are afraid? Maybe that's why they're carrying a gun. Maybe that's why they're feeling the need to defend themselves.
No, absolutely. We certainly talk to young people all the time who are afraid and feel as though they have to carry in order to protect themselves. But Cole and I actually are leaving here to go to a mediation right after this show today. And this is a problem that started in a school that escalated in terms of a huge fight. And what we'll do is we'll sit down with those students and we'll sit down with their parents and also teachers and kind of talk about what happened and why it happened and how it could have been prevented. So those are the kinds of methods that we use to really stop this whole notion of conflict and interpersonal kind of conflict and getting out in front of it. Because all too often we know a conflict can escalate over the weekend to a gunshot. And so if, in fact, we know about it, and oftentimes school principals and others in the community contact us about some beef that's ongoing with these two individuals, we can reach out to those individuals and say, listen, we need to sit down and we need to resolve this before someone actually gets hurt.
And they want to talk?
Absolutely, because the thing is, if, in fact, they can walk away without being killed, that's a win. Because they don't want to die. And that's the other thing that we often hear. Young people don't want to die. They want to do whatever they can to stay alive. So if we can help them in terms of resolving this dispute without them, you know, being killed in the process, they're all for it.
You know, Scott Thompson, as you all are talking, something Marla said earlier in the hour, which is in Philadelphia a couple of years ago, more than 5,000 young people were either shot or killed with a gun. I mean, just the prevalence of gun, the accessibility of gun. I know there's some kind of a gun pipeline that comes up the East Coast. And, of course, Camden and Philadelphia, right along that pipeline, I believe it comes up I-95. But can you speak to what we've been talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have New Jersey has, I believe it's the second most strictest gun laws in the country. But what we find is essentially 80% of all of our crime guns are not coming from the state of New Jersey. They're coming up what's called the Iron Pipeline.
The Iron Pipeline, right.
Down from the southern states and out west. Far too often we find the overwhelming majority of our guns are coming from Pennsylvania. They're coming from Virginia. They're coming from Ohio. They're coming from places that people can walk into a gun show and walk out with a trunk full of guns and come back into our inner cities and start to sell it out as though they're DVDs. But it just that lends itself to the problem with us trying to stem the proliferation of guns on the street. But really the underlying issue that we're all trying to address here is absolutely what Colin was just saying is the – you know, there was a book written not too long ago by Elijah Anderson called The Code of the Street.
Absolutely.
And – what you find is that there is a culture of violence. There is a in the inner city. There is respect that one must try to maintain, and that assault on manhood is generally what precipitates a lot of your violence. And we find far too often a lot of this is also coming from Facebook postings and social media, and you know what one initially looks at as though this is a drug gang dispute, really isn't. It's over a girl. It's over being mean mugged. It's something that's so simple and senseless that really that's where our efforts are trying to come in and start to change. You know, the medium for dispute resolution should not be lead.
That meaning of gun, of course. Let me get Elizabeth from, looks like Vineland, to join us on Radio Times. Elizabeth, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Yes, I wanted to chirp in real quick with a commentary on it. I noticed you guys were talking a lot about, you know, prevention programs before the culture of violence sort of grabs hold of these at-risk kids. My day job is actually a medical transporter, so I end up working with a lot of these, both teenagers who are at risk currently and also adults who were at-risk youth and have now fallen into this, you know, either culture of violence and criminal activity or, more often than not, drug abuse. And what I've noticed when I talk to them is that they all said the same thing, is that as, you know, teenagers and children, they never really had opportunities to discover their own creative gifts. And when you think about it, more and more schools, the first things when they need to make budget cuts, they cut creative programs like art, music, things like that, where a child can really, you know, discover themselves creatively and what they can do and what their gifts are, which can help them, you know, lead to being more productive members of society and as adults. When you have that sort of confidence built through creativity, that I can offer something. You know, I can live in a box in an alley, but you know what? I'm a painter. I can offer something wonderful to society. It really changes, you know, your whole thought process and your confidence in yourself, and makes it harder for you to go and, you know, fall into these let's say cultural violence extracurriculars, where it's like, oh, what am I going to do this afternoon? Well, I can join a gang, or I can have sex, or, you know, when there's not that, those programs where
sure.
kids can, you know,
I hear you.
Have those outlets.
No, I appreciate it.
I think that really contributes.
Absolutely. Elizabeth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Colin, can I toss that to you? I mean, in certain ways, not only anyone, certainly these young people, we're talking about finding their natural gifts, but also literally having things to do. Is that part of the problem? People with time on their hands.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, unfortunately, you know, there's an overwhelming statistic of single parent households. And I met far too many women who are actually out there working one, two jobs in order to provide the necessities for their family. So you have, you know, provision, but there's no supervision. So now PlayStation, auto theft, you know, they emulate in the PlayStations. We get in social media to entertain our children. You know, when I come up, they didn't have this type of media, social networking that they have now. We had to be creative. We went outside and we created, we made things fun games to do. When you constantly bombard, I mean, one of the names that they say social media is Antichrist. And I don't think it's a, put it like this, Antichrist. We're in a position now that a lot of these children don't know who he is.
Mm. You're talking about Jesus Christ.
Right. Or even know God in general, because they constantly bombarded through repetition with this social media and this new technology that's going on. And a lot of these parents, which to me should be redefined, parenthood, they leave social media and leave the music and leave these individuals to raise their children. That is a psychosis. That's an arrested of development. And therefore, it's just a matter of time that they will be arrested because of that lack of development. Hmm. These are the type of children, young men and women that we see. I proposed a question to the school today. I said, if life give you a lemon, what should you do? Well, the average one of them said, make lemonade. That's not good enough. It might have been good enough back in 1952, but that's not good enough. If you give me a lemon, then I'm going to take those lemon seeds and I'm going to go cultivate those lemon seeds. But that means I got a duty. I got work to do. I got to find fertile ground. And I got to use the necessary tools to keep the weeds and the grass from growing up and threatening my seed. Because when you got weeds and you got grass in the way that one think, here come the snakes and pests. This is why your mind get preoccupied and you start making the wrong decisions. Because you can't see the nourishment. You can't see the life that you have because it's being choked out because of your environment. So we want to do, we want to pull out the weed whackers. Sometimes we got to get on our knees and get dirty to try to cultivate so you can learn to cultivate. And we all got a lemon orchard from one lemon.
I love your metaphors, Elizabeth. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Did you want to add something, Marla?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that we try to do is engage our young people in a lot of different activities. Certainly, we understand that employment is the goal for some of them. But right now, we're actually trying to identify community service projects for them because we do need to try to keep them busy. They do have too much idle time on their hands. And so many of them are more than willing to help shovel snow or help paint a hall or something in a school. And so we're actively looking for those projects. But I want to say, just in terms of the caller, because I do have an opportunity to spend some time with our clients. And I believe, and this is what I tell all of them, that all of us come here with a gift. And all too often, for whatever reason, we don't kind of determine what that gift is. Maybe never. But I think that one of the things that they need to learn early on is there's something that they've been gifted to do, whether it's, you know, craft, art, speaking, you know, putting together a car or something like that. We need to help them figure out what that is and then build on that. Because all too often, even the parents don't see it. But that's something that we talk to them about, really trying to identify what you're good at naturally.
Let me get, looks like Rhett from Lewistown to join us. Rhett, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes.
Hi there.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The first thing I want to say is I commend all of your guests. It's wonderful to hear about this involvement, and I hope there's a lot more of it. your guest who did a lot of time there. I hope that he spoke a lot and planted a lot of seeds while he was in, because I don't think there's anybody that can speak to this youth like people that have living experience. The police certainly have their part to play. Now I want to get a little cynical.
Okay.
I haven't heard the race aspect of this issue talked about one bit, and I know that's a whole different conversation, but we must all, anybody who's intelligent and thinks about this, must acknowledge that the racial element is tremendous here. In other words, I'm hearing an awful lot about drug addiction. Now that it has reached the white and the more affluent community, there's an awful lot of interest in it. There's a lot of people that now that have their hands on the levers of power want to do something. But until, you know, this is still basically a black and a brown problem, and it stays within those communities primarily. So that's the cynical part of my thinking on this whole thing.
Sure,
and once again, I just really am inspired by listening to your guests, and hope springs eternal.
Thanks, thanks a lot, Red. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Marla, how much is race an issue? As Red said, we're talking largely about people of color, black and
absolutely. Brown. I mean, certainly when we kind of talk about the stat of 5,000 young people being shot and or killed, you know, many of them are black and brown children. And, you know, the question always is raised, would our response or lack of response be the same, you know, if in fact we were talking about Caucasian children? But one of the things that we try to say is that violence impacts us all. And that's what we're really trying to encourage. That's why we're trying to encourage everyone, whether you live, work, and play in our neighborhood, it impacts you. I can't tell you how many teachers, for instance, you know, certainly are impacted negatively when they lose a student, or, you know, certainly a police officer. I mean, we're all entwined. I mean, it's something that impacts us all. So while we certainly see, you know, the number of African-American males in particular who are engaged in terms of the criminal justice system and certainly gunshot victims, I think that all of us have a role to play. If, in fact, you know, we are human and we are caring individuals.
I'm giving you the last word, Scott Thompson. Go ahead.
Well, I think that the last caller was absolutely on point. A lot of this is predicated upon the pathologies of poverty, and those pathologies of poverty are disproportionately impacting on the socioeconomic scale the inner cities, and through many, many, many different institutional decisions over the decades in the history of our country has led to these populations being disproportionately black and brown. And I do agree, and with what I see, that there have been over the course of history, there have been mainstream solutions to try to fix these outlier issues. And the outlier issues are overwhelmingly represented by a group of individuals wherein far too long the only solution we have given to this is incarceration. And I think it just needs a different perspective. I think it's one in which we look at it as a disease. We look at this as a public health approach. We take more of a CDC perspective than a war on drugs perspective. And I think that we'll get more meaningful solutions from that in the long run.
Well, we could go on, and I do appreciate all three of you joining us today on Radio Times. Such an important topic. Scott Thompson, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me on, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's chief of the Camden County Police Department. Marla Davis Bellamy, thank you very much as well.
Thank you. We commend you also for embracing this issue.
Oh, absolutely. No, I appreciate that. And she's director of the Philadelphia Ceasefire Program based at the Katz School of Medicine at Temple University. And a particular thanks to you, Colwyn Williams, for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
No problem. And he's been working with Philadelphia Ceasefire for about 3 years now as an outreach worker. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. It's produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.